Namaste and blessings. The Swami welcomes you with great love and great respect to Mahadeva, Mahayoga. This is the system discussed, explained, and initiated through this show, Meditative Living with Swami Sivananda Giri. Thank you to our best friend in the broadcast world, Sonic Aitchison, over in Brighton, England, who pushes the buttons, plays the music, and does his best to keep this show running smooth. Today, we are going to finish Chapter 2. Of the authoritative Guru Gita of His Holiness Mahamandaleshwar Paramahamsa Swarupananda Vishwaguru Maharaj of Los Angeles, California. And as a bit of an introduction to this version of the text, Sanatana Dharma, which translated to English would mean the eternal natural way. Okay, it's better and more frequently referred to as Hinduism, but it is entirely founded upon the guru, student, devotee, initiate, disciple, Swami relationship. The Guru Gita is the most comprehensive work on that particular subject. While there are many versions of Guru Gita, this effort contains an original translation of the complete version, which consists of 352 shlokas, or as this Swami prefers to say, verses. Additionally, this book, the authoritative Guru Gita, includes a commentary that is notable for several different reasons. First, it provides insight into the philosophies and traditions that the author or authors of the original ancient Guru Gita text drew from. Now, these, namely, are these traditions and philosophies. Kashmir Shaivism, Srividya, and possibly some form of what is referred to as Vaishnavism. Now that is where the practitioners hold the Ishwara, or the preferred or chosen representation of Supreme, in the form and the name of Vishnu or Krishna or Ram, that sort of thing. Okay. These all come together in the Guru Gita, ancient text. Now, the authoritative Guru Gita also includes its original Sanskrit. Now, this is in the Roman script, you know, like written with English ABCs, rather than the Devanagari. So that we can chant Guru Gita in either English or Sanskrit. Now, the Sanskrit has certain benefits and effects, but if that's too much and too difficult, the English will do. Finally, this commentary in this book is noteworthy because it was composed at the request and under the close supervision of Mahamandaleshwar Swarupananda, this Swami's guru, who is, well, became in 2007 the first white-skinned American-born human being entered into the rank of the 80 Mahamandaleshwars. And this makes a Mahamandaleshwar a theological authority. The weight of a Mahamandaleshwar's stance on most anything is second only within Sanatana Dharma, is second only to the four Shankaracharyas in India. We are part of we are under the Shankaracharya in Kanchipur. That probably won't mean much of anything to much of anyone, but this truly is the authoritative position on the Guru Gita. Now, we're not going to give a whole lot of setup, going to assume and recommend, if this is the first episode for you, you should really go back on www.type1radio.com and start with number one. That is important, and there is reason for it. Now, let us continue with the text, which is a conversation between Shiva and his wife, Parvati, because she asked, how does a normal, regular human being become like Shiva? Is that possible? How is it done? The Guru Gita, or Song of the Guru, keeping in mind, Guru only means the knowledge that removes the ignorance, or the light that removes the darkness. That's what that word means. All right. Verse 215. Shiva said to Parvati, repetition of the Guru Gita is the destroyer of untimely death. It protects one from every variety of suffering. It protects one from ghosts, demons, spirits, thieves, and wild animals. The commentary. Although it is a hard thing to describe, this is Swami Anantanandagiri here, I must admit that I have always felt somehow protected. I do believe that ghosts, demons, and spirits sometimes harass people. Until her dying breath, my grandmother maintained she had once been assaulted by a demon, which she described in great detail, and which had unsuccessfully tried to suffocate her. I've also noticed that such afflictions by paranormal entities seem to be hereditary. My mother and my sister also have had issues with such things, including, but not limited to, what were perceived to be ghosts and extraterrestrials. In fact, it was in response to my mother's complaint of having issues with ghosts that I first urged her to begin reading the Guru Gita daily. As I sit here writing these words, it has been about 2 years, and there have been no subsequent complaints of malevolent or mischievous spirits from my mother. I've always had two subtle impressions that I see as interrelated. As already mentioned, one of these is that something somehow is actively protecting me from influences to which I've been exposed and which typically impact people negatively. I have also always somehow had this sense of belonging to God. Even when I rejected the notion of God that my religion had presented to me as a child, I was never able to completely lose the feeling that God was present with me, or the yearning to better understand what that means. This later manifested as my acceptance of my guru, but in a way, I was always his. I was always under his protection. There have been certain events in my life that have reinforced this sentiment. For example, when I was 13, I was riding a motorcycle, lost control when I hit a hill and caught some air. I flew off the motorcycle at high velocity and right between the upper two strands of barbed wire on a barbed wire fence. Somehow, I came out of the ordeal without a single scratch on my body. My denim jeans, however, were shredded. When I was 28, I flew off a motorcycle yet again. This time, hit a patch of sand while applying my brakes on the interstate. I flew off onto the shoulder, and rather than durable motorcycle gear, I was wearing gym clothes, namely basketball shorts and a warm-up jacket. At the speed I was going, it's a miracle I didn't break my neck, let alone any other bones. In fact, the only damage done was a chunk of skin missing from the hand I used to break my fall, and some road rash further up the same arm. While it all happened extremely quickly, everything seemed to be happening very slowly. I had time to think to myself, well, looks like this is it. It looked to me like I was about to die, yet I wasn't disturbed by this in the least. I was utterly at peace and actually enjoyed the flight as I soared headlong in full-on Superman pose to the pavement. Along with the peace that washed over me, I also felt a sensation of being lifted that I can't fully describe. Yet, it felt to me like something more than simply the sensation of being thrown from the bike or the rush of endorphins in the brain. The fact that I wasn't seriously injured lends credence, in my mind at least, to the idea that the lift that I felt was nothing short of divine intervention. My guru had just uttered to me for the first time a couple months earlier a phrase that I was to come to know as one of his hallmarks. Quote, "Don't worry, you're under the Guru Protection Plan." This Swami could go on and on with similar anecdotes, stories, this, that, and the other thing. But simply, clearly understand there's something to all of this. And there are times when necessary and appropriate, very odd things take place. Let's go to verse 216. Shiva said to Parvati, "This Guru Gita is the destroyer of all evils. It is the destroyer of gruesome diseases such as leprosy. Whatever benefits one derives from living with the Guru can be obtained by reading the Guru Gita." The commentary. I once read a story about a devotee of Sri Ramana Maharshi who was unable to work because of a debilitating spinal condition. Sri Ramana assured him upon his arrival at the ashram that the issue would be fixed for him just by sitting in the presence of the Maharshi for a few days. His condition was cured. He returned to his duty, having also received a glimpse of the self, the big S self. At the age of 14 or 15, I began suffering seasonal allergies. Each year, this would go on for 3 to 6 months. My eyes would constantly stream tears. I always had snot running down my face, and I would develop severe migraines from constantly blowing my nose. As I grew older, I would have to miss work often because of this. I couldn't really do anything while this was going on except lay in bed feeling like my head was going to explode. One summer, when I was 27 years old, I met my Guruji in person for the first time. This is the first time I received Shaktipat from him in person. I'd been suffering the usual allergy symptoms all through the spring, right up until the day I met him. I noticed a couple of weeks later, the allergy symptoms hadn't appeared since that day. It's been years now since I've suffered hay fever or a migraine. Well, perhaps it wasn't a gruesome bout of leprosy, but It was cured by Guru's grace alone, and I am supremely grateful. Verse 217. Shiva says to Parvati, the Guru Gita is the destroyer of great diseases. By its repetition, one can acquire supernatural powers, or siddhis, attract and keep others under their subordination, or can liberate themselves from the same if they are the victim of someone's ill will. The commentary. Do not take this shloka, or verse, as an endorsement of such behavior. The information is here. The reader is free to use it or misuse it as he or she will. However, as we have had occasion to discuss already, actions have consequences. Actions stemming from desires such as the acquisition of siddhis and the subjugation of others will have effects that are less than desirable. Kindly allow this Swami to expand a bit here. After having been an intense martial arts practitioner and achieving a bit of name and recognition, participating in the World Breaking Championship on ESPN back in the day, performing demonstrations live on local news morning shows, all that sort of stuff. Found it to be entirely unsatisfying. And really, because this mind was in an imbalanced state and desirous of recognition, name and fame, power, influence, you know, it didn't do any of those things that the mind wanted. And this individual chased after. Now, the skills of themselves are useful. The training, useful. And this Swami believes that that training and energetic control gained through Qigong practices and learning to express internal energy outside of the body into targets and such, perhaps stimulated this Swami's Kundalini awakening, which at the time, this Swami had no clue what was happening. But it did, and it set this Swami on a whole different path of education, investigation, experiences, etc. Returning to the text, verse 218. Shiva said to Parvati, sitting upon a seat made of durva grass, kusha grass, or upon a clean blanket, one should single-mindedly repeat the Guru Gita. The commentary. Here is where we are beginning to get into the occultic, the esoteric, the means by which One can make very quick progress. One can achieve things. One can protect themselves from things, all sorts of stuff, which we'll get very deep into later. But the commentary here, the subject of the yogi seat is one that is addressed in many yogic tracts and emphasized by many teachers. One reason that has been suggested for this is that a proper seat for meditation or japa, meaning repetition of mantra, that seat should insulate the seated yogi from subtle earth currents that are counterproductive to his or her practice. So here we're not grounding. That's silly. We are trying to transcend, move upward. Not to us, this whole new agey grounding thing, that's kind of like trying to go water skiing with cement blocks on your feet. It's just not going to work. Back to the commentary. Another important consideration is stability and comfort. The yogi should choose a posture that is stable without causing discomfort. Padmasana, the lotus posture, is probably the most frequently recommended. In the lotus posture, the yogi sits with legs crossed, each foot resting sole up on the opposite thigh. Siddhasana, also known as the easy posture, is a variant that puts less strain on the knees. In the easy posture, the yogi puts one foot under the opposite thigh and the other atop the opposite thigh. Concerning this point, the Bhagavad Gita says that the seat should be neither too high nor too low. One good reason for this statement is that sitting on a cushion that is the right height, it is easier for the yogi to maintain a straight spine. Furthermore, the opening of the hips that this promotes causes a significant amount of tension to be removed from the knees that would otherwise be present in one of these cross-legged postures. I recommend using what is called a zafu, Z-A-F-U, a round cushion popular in Zen Buddhism. Why bother with one of these postures? Well, if they can be maintained without significant discomfort, well, they promote a noticeably calmer mind, deeper meditation, and the upward flow of kundalini within the spine. Additionally, the three points of contact between the ground, the seat, and two knees provide a very stable base of support. This makes it possible to remain seated upright with less effort. This is helpful, as it is generally preferable to falling over when one is absorbed in meditative bliss and consequently losing bodily consciousness. The insulative properties mentioned earlier also come into play in the matter of comfort. Materials like the kusha grass and animal skins recommended here and in other scriptures also happen to be excellent insulators from energies such as heat and cold. Once I was camping and couldn't sleep due to the cold ground. It occurred to me to use my meditation seat, which consists of a kusha mat and a wool blanket, as a bedroll. It did a superb job of insulating me from the cold, and I slept very comfortably after that. It is difficult enough to remain one-pointed in meditation or japa practice when the mind is the yogi's only distraction. For that reason, it is generally worthwhile to make provisions for removing discomfort from the equation. Finally, the color of the seat is an opportunity to apply various laws in order to help facilitate the desired outcome as described above. The first example of this occurs in the following verse, which we will get to after the bottom of the hour break song when we return with Meditative Living. Namaste and blessings. That was the initiatory mantra of Mahadeva Mahayoga, which this Swami teaches, initiates, supports, and greatly enjoys observing the apparent others make progress with. If you should care to come into closer contact with this Swami, you are invited to go to www.swami.info. There you'll find the email address, and this Swami answers all email. If you have a question, a comment, a complaint, whatever, more than happy to hear from you. Now, let's return to the authoritative Guru Gita. Verse 219. Now, this is the beginning of the direct occult, which only means hidden, esoteric, which only means inward, instructions for yogis, regardless of their lineage, type of worship, type of practice, whatever. This will work for everybody, regardless. Verse 219, Shiva said to Parvati, one should use a white seat for all purposes, a red seat to subordinate others. One should sit in the lotus posture and repeat the Guru Gita to attain supreme peace. The commentary. At this point, the Guru Gita transitions from describing the benefits incurred from its repetition in general to more specific outcomes that can be effected by its repetition in conjunction with certain intentions. But it does not stop there. It also offers various external supports to help reinforce these intentions and desired outcomes. This is where the magical correspondences discussed at some length prior make their debut. Here, we see the theme of the Guru Gita's magical efficacy as a potent mantra developed further. Now, the Swami is about to launch into a series of verses without commentary and just run right through, beginning with verse 220. Shiva instructs Parvati. By sitting on a seat made of cloth, one will attain poverty. A seat of stone can potentially bring disease. Sitting upon bare earth will bring suffering. A wooden seat will not bear fruit. Sitting on a black antelope skin, one will obtain knowledge of the self. A seat of kusha grass is also appropriate towards this end. Liberation is acquired sitting on a tiger skin. Upon a seat of wool, everything is acquired. Stepping away for a moment, that's what this Swami sits on, white wool. Gifted to this Swami by Swami Anantananda Giri, who wrote this. Verse 222. Shiva instructs Parvati. Performing japa facing southeast will bring the power to attract others. Facing northwest will destroy one's enemies. Facing southwest will bring about visions of gods and other worlds. And facing northeast will bring about knowledge. That's with a capital K. Performing this japa facing north will bring about peace of mind. Facing east will bring the power to subjugate others. Facing south will bring about the death of enemies. Facing west will bring wealth. Shiva goes on. Repetition of the Guru Gita attracts all beings. It frees one from all bondage. It is very dear to Indra. He's the king of the gods. It has the power to subjugate even kings. Repetition of the Guru Gita will stop the speech of one's enemies. It increases one's virtues. It puts an end to bad actions and promotes good actions. Shiva continues the instruction. Actions otherwise impossible to perform are successfully carried out. Fear of the negative influences of the nine planets is removed. Bad dreams are destroyed, and good dreams will be seen to bear truth. O auspicious one, this Gita will replace one's confusion with peace of mind. It will destroy all bondage. This Gita is indeed the abode of knowledge. Shiva continues. Whatever one desires, he will surely attain. The Guru Gita, most assuredly, is very auspicious and meritorious. It always destroys the three types of suffering: physical, mental, and spiritual. It always bestows peace. It bestows a good son to a barren woman. It prevents the widowhood of women and increases all auspiciousness. Continuing the instruction, Shiva says, it brings about longevity, health, and wealth. It bestows sons and grandchildren. If a widow recites the Guru Gita without any expectations, she will attain liberation. If a widow repeats the Guru Gita with expectations, she will not become a widow in future births. All her afflictions, sorrows, and obstacles will be destroyed. Whatever one may desire, whether it be atonement for sins, righteousness or dharma, wealth, enjoyment, or liberation, one will surely attain it. The Guru Gita is like the celestial cow, the celestial tree, and the celestial jewel, fulfilling all desires felt and sought after. It is the bestower of all auspiciousness. If one writes the Guru Gita by hand and worships it, he will attain liberation. In his heart, a special devotion to Guru will always arise. Worshippers of different representations of the Absolute, such as Shiva, Vishnu, Ganapati or Ganesh, the sun, the goddess Shakti, they all perform the japa of the Guru Gita. This is the truth. There is no doubt about this. Now, the commentary. The above cited cults, now we don't say that with disparaging intent. Perhaps it would have been, well, this Swami would have said probably sects, S-E-C-T-S. But These would have been known to the author or authors of the original Guru Gita text, who therefore would have known that these are all systems that are compatible with the path presented herein. Regardless of the name or form to which they choose to offer worship, with the correct theoretical understanding of monism, the adoption of yogic discipline, and having surrendered oneself to the guru, any adherent to whatever specific sect is effectively performing the japa of the Guru Gita. They may not literally be reading the words printed on the pages, but walking the path that it advocates. One obtains all of its merits. No one, anywhere, holds a monopoly on God or the knowledge thereof. Thus ends the second chapter in the conversation of Parvati and Shiva in the Uttarakhanda of Sri Skanda Purana. Next week, we will move more deeply into the authoritative Guru Gita as we begin the third and final chapter. Kindly allow this, Swami, to share a few things. When it comes to abilities, powers, and such, the majority of the time, those chasing after such things will wind up disappointed, doing harm to themselves and others. When siddhis, or powers, or whatever, there are all sorts of them. There are eight primary that we're going to get to later. But when these occur just naturally, all on their own, just happens, whoop, that's fine. No problem. You can be just as amazed as anyone else, you know? And then such things cease carrying the description miracle because they just happen. They really, really do. The Swami's had the opportunity to witness a great many things, but not particularly impressed with any of them. Some were a little scary. Some were tempting. But just because they happen does not mean you're done. Okay? Not in the least bit. You begin playing at a higher level with some more temptation thrown in. And you must keep yourself under control, balanced, and not fall prey to the temptation of misuse of anything in any way ever. That's how it works. This Swami can testify that if some terrible threat to the body of a yogi occurs, there is intervention. And couldn't say exactly how it happens. Could make up a very mystical story about it. But when it's happening, oh! It's entirely appropriate to be dumbfounded and awed by what could have happened, but for whatever reason, did not. This is how it is. And this is how this Swami would like you to feel. Not wishing to impress you or any of... No. I want you to have your own experience. Your own expansion of consciousness. Your own awareness. The books that have been written, speeches that have been given are, you know, useful. They point, but they're not the goal. And it is not available until you turn the senses inward, upward, and outward. Anything short of that ends up through data received with either physical or psychic senses. And this Swami will assure you anything you can describe in language, eat it. Nope. Far less than the goal. Enjoyable as it may be, or frightening as it might be, or confusing as it might be, that ain't it. And something that just came and went, ain't it? What we are seeking and finding, step by step, day by day, repetition by repetition, is what is infinite, eternal, and has no descriptors, attributes, or qualities at all. That is the source from which all manifests and to which all returns. So, once again, thank you ever so much for allowing this Swami to be a part of your life. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being you. Because see, this Swami couldn't be you. You got to be you. The one became the many, so the many become the one again. That's the whole game right there. That's the play within consciousness. And consciousness is within you. It's always already been the case. You just had to forget in order to play your part under the name and through the body for now. For a time within space. That's pretty much how it works. And you are worthy. Your history is not your future. It has effects, sure enough. But it doesn't have to limit you. It doesn't have to. And please let this Swami testify, surrender and waiting is the hardest part for the mind. For the body, it's not quite so difficult. Some of us can get through that part relatively easily. It's the mental aspect. Then once the outwardly focused mind and the inwardly focused psychic phenomena have been controlled and mastered. Then there's the spirit. And all of these come step by step by step, but not necessarily in a logical order. Not like a college curriculum at all. It happens when it happens, in the way it happens, depending on your karmic load, what's right for you happens. What you do with it, how you respond to it, that's up to you. That's the point of all the forgetting. That's the point of gaining the cities, the powers. Oh, will you use them right? Will you misuse them? Will you ignore them completely? All part of the play. Again, let this Swami say thank you with great love and great respect from the heart of all. Namaste. We'll see you next week. Om Namo Narayana.